For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder. Last August, heavily armed police in Marikana, South Africa, opened fire on striking mine workers, causing the deaths of 47 people ultimately and injuring 78, an action that set off a wave of wildcat strikes that have crippled the mining industry and drawn support from other social movements. At the time of the massacre, the governing African National Congress, or ANC, condemned the violence but refrained from criticizing the police. This week, ANC delegates elected as deputy president a black entrepreneur and former union leader who now sits on the board of the company that owns the Marikana mine and who had called for government intervention against the striking miners. Patrick Bond is a political economist and senior professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal School of Development Studies in Durban, South Africa, where he directs the Center for Civil Society. Professor Bond is the author of a number of books, including The Politics of Climate Justice, Looting Africa, Talk Left, Walk Right, Elite Transition, and Unsustainable South Africa. He joins us live from Durban, South Africa. Professor Bond, welcome to the program.
It's really very good to be back with you and your listeners, Amy. Thanks very much for having me.
Yes, we last spoke in August on the heels of that massacre, the Marikana massacre, as it's now known. Bring us up to date on that struggle, what it was about, for those who don't know about it, and how it's playing out.
Well, sure, Amy. As you recall, there were 34 men, mine workers, the rock drill operators, they're called. They're the ones at the coal face of the mining, and this is a platinum mine. It's run by lawmen, and it's in a very sort of desolate area about a couple of hours west of Johannesburg driving, and it's part of a big sort of a belt of platinum that's about 80% of the world's platinum. And so when the lawmen miners, maybe 3,000, got out on a hill, they did a wildcat strike. They sat up on a hill for about 6 days, and they were eventually shot off the hill with water cannon and rubber bullets. And as they ran, hundreds ran into one particular spot where 16 were mowed down by the police. And then another 18 were killed a little bit further away, and altogether 78 wounded, 270 arrested. The other 2,500 escaped into the nearby shack settlement. And this is the Marikana massacre. And it's under investigation at the moment through a commission, a special government commission, and it's really showing the incompetence of the police. But more importantly, that the major figure associated with black mining at the moment, Cyril Ramaphosa, who this week was elected number two in the African National Congress, the ruling party, Nelson Mandela's Liberation Party. He had actually sent the emails, the smoking gun, sort of dripping blood emails, saying the day before this massacre that the police and the mining minister must intervene on behalf of the company. And just to remind listeners, the company, Lonmin, used to be called Lonro, London and Rhodesia, and it used to be run by Tiny Roland. And in 1973, about 40 years ago, it was called the, quote, unacceptable face of capitalism by the British Prime Minister, a Tory, a conservative, Edward Heath. And so what we're looking at, Amy, is a crony capitalism that is amongst the most extreme. I know you have extreme Washington, D.C., Wall Street nexus of corporations buying your politicians. But in South Africa, now it's in the mining sector, and Cyril Ramaphosa is right at the center of it, and ironically, he's the one brought in this week as the ANC had its every 5 years a quintennial congress to give the current president, Jacob Zuma, some credibility. One last point. It's that the Marikana workers, these lawmen platinum miners, they struggled on 3 weeks after the massacre, the survivors, and they were still on strike, and finally they settled with lawmen. And the settlement was huge. It was 22% as advertised around the country. It was a little bit less, but this is what they claimed and what the company agreed was the average increase for these rock drill operators. Now, what that did was to set off an amazing wildcat strike wave that exposed the trade union movement as really incompetent in maintaining sort of corporate, let me call it, it's a collective bargaining regime that allowed big business, big government, big labor, like in the United States, for so many years with the AFL-CIO, with the Harry Truman's regime, with big business, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, to set up a sort of elite labor aristocracy.
And this is the National Union of Mine Workers, Patrick?
Well, that's right. That was a particular union that represented mine workers until this year. And what happened this year, really starting off in January, was that the competitive union, it's called AMCU, the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union, and AMCU moved in where the mine workers were way too cozy. They'd even had investments in banks associated with extreme microcredit exploitation. They were on the boards of these companies. The leaders of the mine workers traditionally then became the leaders of the African National Congress itself. There was a sort of ladder from NUM, the biggest of the unions within the big Congress of South African Trade Unions Federation, about 330,000 members, and they essentially became part and parcel of managing corporatism in the most unequal country in the world, where we have the highest degree of labor militancy and the most protest per person in the world by all the objective measures. And so it was just untenable. And the NUM, National Union of Mine Workers Leadership, actually recommended that 9,000 of these longmen workers be fired. That was about a year ago. And of course, that meant that as they were becoming more militant, they looked for a different organizing option. And that's where AMCU came in, and NUM is being discredited and probably losing its place as the largest union, the metal workers union now taking its place. But the main point is that KASATU as a whole, as a traditional force for progressive politics, nobody would deny that it's been the most powerful progressive force in this country over probably the last 35 years. It has basically been unveiled as behind the times, and the striking workers, not just in the mines, and about 100,000 went on strike as the 22% deal was announced, but also transport, and they cut a very good deal. The whole national transport system went into paralysis in September. And then in October, November, the vineyards and the Western Cape the farms went on strike, the farm workers. In addition, there were some auto workers and municipal workers. So we saw a sort of wildfire of striking workers across this country, which combined with the community protests, including in Marikana itself, service delivery protests, this has represented a really formidable challenge and shows a big split in the obvious liberation forces between those who want to push forward a class analysis, a class struggle mixed with racial justice, gender justice, environment on the one hand, and those that unfortunately still believe, like Cyril Ramaphosa, the former revolutionary leader, now a major shareholder in Lonmin, and the man who wrote the emails calling in the police, that South Africa's status quo should remain. And so that's what we've seen this whole last week, a big convention of the ruling party with desperate efforts to keep the game in play, to keep the status quo intact, and yet they pulled in to accompany Jacob Zuma, one of the most, I think, illegitimate business leaders in the country's history, as of August 15, the day before the massacre, when Cyril Ramaphosa called in the police and the mining minister to, as they said, declare D-Day on behalf of Lonmin, the big London mining house.
Thank you. Sorry to jump in. Just to explain this idea of wildcat strikes, these would be strikes that occur outside of any kind of official union sanction. Is that right?
That's right. The wildcat, it's just as it has been in the U.S. I mean, the great sit-down strikes in the 1930s and all of the efforts that independent progressive unions have made all over the United States. I mean, you could, in a sense, say Madison, Wisconsin reflected many of these sort of wildcat sentiments from the base. And then you get these bureaucrats in the unions, and I know that was also the case in Wisconsin, wasn't it, that just get fearful of this rumble of class consciousness and class mobilization. And at that point, the wildcat, you're right, it's not an officially sanctioned strike. It's outside collective bargaining, and it usually these are three-year agreements, the collective bargaining deals. And the mine workers felt that the National Union of Mine Workers, their union, had really sold them out, and they said, well, we can do better, and they therefore demanded, roughly a doubling of their wage, and they got 22%, which when inflation is about 6%, it is seen as a huge victory. So this is one of the most exciting developments, that even after a massacre, and don't forget how traumatized everyone was, and that the police continue to move in. They've been on this Farlam Commission this last couple of weeks, and I have a piece in Counterpunch and Z explaining it, but the police have testified that they did everything by the book, and that meant there was a massacre. And if you look at actually what happened, and the facts are becoming crystal clear, these policemen were out for an extraordinary burst of revenge, and that's why 34 people were killed, many actually shot in the back, shot between the eyes, many surrendering, some driven over by the huge big Inyalas, the big trucks of the police. A real gruesome massacre by a police that deserves the label, I think, proto-fascist.
And this leader, well, former union leader, I guess he co-founded the National Union of Mine Workers, Cyril Ramaphosa, right?
Yes, well, yeah, maybe your listeners will even recall if they were, as I was, educated in the anti-apartheid movement, doing solidarity in the 1980s in the U.S. Cyril Ramaphosa was extraordinary. He in fact, had some Trotskyist roots in the Marxist workers' tendency, and then he became one of the great leaders as a young man of the mine workers. He was responsible, more than anyone, for running a national strike. Nobody thought it possible in 1987, right in the sort of prime moment of apartheid repression, and Ramaphosa very courageously brought a couple of 100,000 mine workers out on strike. It was a real decisive moment here. And what happened after that to Cyril Ramaphosa is very telling, because he became the Secretary General, effectively the President of the African National Congress, working with Nelson Mandela. Mandela was the President of the ANC and then became President of the country from 94 to 99. But then what happened to Ramaphosa was very emblematic, because Thabo Mbeki edged him out to become Mandela's successor. And Mbeki, as your listeners must know, was a very conflicted character who, great intellectual, but had very strange ideas.
They may not know, actually, about, most people, I guess, have heard of him in connection with his refusal to... Yes.
Exactly. And we even describe his policies as genocidal, because over 350,000 South Africans lost their lives because Mbeki refused to give them medicines. And those medicines, incidentally, last month were credited with raising life expectancy from 52, which was a great drop because of AIDS, in the 1990s and until about 2004. And today it's up to 60, so a rise of 8 years over the past 8 years. It's extraordinarily, I think, testimonial to the treatment action campaign, to the activists who said we still need these medicines, even if the President of South Africa and Bill Gates with his intellectual property and the World Trade Organization and the big pharma corps and the Clinton and then the Bush regimes initially refused to concede. And so that was one of our great successes. And at that point, you see, Cyril Ramaphosa, our key figure this week, because of his elevation to number two man in South African politics in a race for deputy president of the ruling party. And probably, in fact, there's even talk this week of him having some sort of informal prime minister function in the government, because the president, Jacob Zuma, isn't coping very well. And the point is here, Ramaphosa loses to Mbeki in the struggle to replace Nelson Mandela back in 95, 96. And Ramaphosa had managed to get the constitution through, but he wasn't given the deputy presidency. He was given an offer of a finance ministry. He said, no thanks, I'll go into business. What happened then was very telling, Amy, because he helped to wreck a couple of big companies, and then finally, from about 2002, struck it rich. And he struck it rich in mining, and also as a franchisee for McDonald's, right, the big junk food chain.
Really?
And this is where Ramaphosa made his billions, and he's over $1 billion in U.S. dollar terms, and second richest black South African, and one of the top 10 in South Africa. So we're looking at a man who is a real nouveau riche, but unfortunately, I mean, he did the other day over $2 million for a prize-winning bull, right, a bull to breed bulls with, and so he sort of unveiled himself as someone who's gone into a wild hedonistic mode of consumption instead of being the old radical mine worker. And this is such an emblem, isn't it, of how the revolutionary impulse in South Africa was diverted, co-opted, and corrupted.
Well, I do want to ask you about that. I'd like to go back and share a little bit
of South African history. But just to clarify, Cyril Ramaphosa's election as deputy president of the ANC, does that put him in line for something like, I don't know, vice presidency? I'm not sure how it works in the political structure
That's quite right. It's a big debate this week. Should he even take on that function today, tomorrow, as soon as he can? What he has to obviously do is get rid of his extreme conflicts of interest, and he has to put a blind trust together and put all of his holdings there. It's a very complicated process for someone as rich and as diversified as Cyril Ramaphosa. But I think the big question is, because the loser in the big battle this week, a man called Halema Motlanthe, who is the vice president, we call him deputy president, he basically ran against Zuma because he felt, as all the reports suggest, a new book by Ibram Harvey also demonstrates, that the man has more principle and dignity and doesn't want to see the ANC going down this slippery slope of corruption and degradation that Jacob Zuma, current president, is taking it. Many examples of it, but the most extreme recently is the expenditure of about $20 million it's more like $25 million on his mansion in his home rural constituency, a tiny little town called Nkandla, where he and his kraal, a big sort of collective of him and his four wives, 22 children, numerous nephews and nieces and all, have got a compound, and the compound with $25 million or so of state and some private provided funding is seen as scandalous, because there's just so much corruption associated with giving this man a sort of mansion back in rural KwaZulu, not too far from where I'm speaking from in Durban, when the rest of the neighborhood, the rural areas there, are absolutely impoverished, no running water, electricity. So many of the concerns about Cyril Ramaphosa are that he is being brought in to legitimize through especially big businesses' contacts that he's developed, a very corrupt crony capitalist system. And my gut feeling, seeing what we've seen, as I've said about Lonmin, is that Cyril Ramaphosa will amplify, not correct, those very tendencies.
You've characterized post-apartheid South Africa as more economically unequal, ecologically degraded, socially desperate, indebted and corrupt than the one that Nelson Mandela inherited from the apartheid regime. Give us a snapshot of South Africa at that particular juncture, the beginning of the post-apartheid period, from an economic and social perspective, and what the possibilities were.
Yes, well, the possibilities were enormous, because the contradictions, as they are today, were amongst the most extreme in the world. But, you know, I've got to say, I like living in South Africa today much more than in the early 1990s. And I moved to South Africa in 1990, and I worked in Mandela's office in 94 and in 96, and I wrote policy papers for his staff. And I really do think it's a better society. But on all the conditions of economy and environment, in a sense, the potential for revolutionary transformation to a better society, we've fallen back. And so there's a non-racial society with a liberal constitution. It only goes so far as you've got money, of course. We've learned that in the past 3 years on the struggle to get free basic water in Soweto. And we realize that although there's a liberal constitution, it's only as strong as the activists fighting for it. And the judges will set you back any chance they have. So I would say that the Gini coefficient, the main measure of inequality, has raced ahead of Brazil, which had been number one major country in the world for inequality, with Lula giving out the Familia Bolsa, the sort of basic grant to families, and doubling the minimum wage. That changed. Brazil became less unequal, but South Africa became more unequal under Mandela, under Mbeki, under the current government of Zuma. And the problem is that those with assets have gotten much richer, so that's basically whites, and a very few blacks who've gotten, they call it a sort of Irish coffee effect, where you've got a big black mass on the bottom, you've got this nice white cream, probably quite full of liqueur fumes sort of milk, and then you've got a few black sprinkles, maybe a bit of cinnamon on the top, and that's the sort of effect that the trade unions describe the economic policies of Mandela the Irish coffee effect, to give the whites a very, very easy breathing space. And many of white South Africans who were rich took their money out of the country forever. And that's one of the great tragedies. On the environmental front, I have to tell you, because I've been working quite a bit on climate, Amy, we've become 20 times worse than even you in the United States, using the measure of the emissions of greenhouse gases per person per unit of GDP. So our economy is more carbon intensive by a factor of 20 than even what we call the great climate Satan, the United States. And so this is really, again, a function of the extraordinary power of the mining sector and their desire for cheap electricity, coal-fired electricity. We're currently seeing the third and fourth largest coal-fired power plants in the world being constructed, the largest World Bank loan ever. It was about 2.5 years ago that Robert Zoellick, the president, authorized it with great protests here against it. And so we're seeing a country continue to degenerate. The rich get richer, the poor poorer. The 1% become more degenerate, and that's really what we've seen last week.
Is the 1% the white minority? What's the distribution?
Well, no, it's plus this very interesting group of a sort of comprador. That's the phrase that is often used, a comprador, sort of collaborative elite in the black community, and those would include neoliberal nationalists. That's a phrase we use. The word liberal in the U.S., I know, and especially in Boston, might confuse, but neoliberal means free market. If you can think of, there's a Boston resident there called Larry Summers, right? Former Harvard president.
Yes, there is.
Of neoliberal. And so that neoliberal, that sort of free marketeer fundamentalism, is mixed with nationalism. And you know what it gives you, Amy? It's interesting. Not something when I was studying in the U.S. and in the East Coast, I never really heard of this before, but we call it here talk left, walk right. And that means you can have a revolutionary background as an African National Congress activist, and you can be caught up in the circuits of capital accumulation here and involved in the most intense class struggle in the world, but on the side of the state or business. But you can talk left so that you can walk right. Talk left, walk right. And that may be, for your listeners, a way to understand how we are often confused, particularly with sometimes radical foreign policy. I mean, this week we also saw the ruling party endorse BDS, the boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israel because of their oppression of Palestinians. That's great. And that's the sort of remembrance I think everyone has that the sanctions, especially, again, you folks in the Boston area being the leaders, to get U.S. corporations out of South Africa. And this is the strategy as well for getting Israel to stop occupying and oppressing Palestinians. And that's the something that's so easy to understand if you're on this side of the fence, probably not so much in the U.S., but it was something that the ANC endorsed this week, a very great step forward. So that's the talk left, but then the walk right means back at home, the poor and working class people, the environment, women, they really get shafted. And Americana was just really the most extreme version of it, but it's happening every day in every way.
I'd like to share with you, there was an opinion piece written earlier this week by Bill Keller, the former executive editor of the New York Times. Actually, he wrote on Sunday that any failure of the ANC government to fulfill the promise of those early days back in 87, well, during the transition, I guess, in 1990, we saw Nelson Mandela here in Boston. He came to visit after he was released. And there were a lot of hopes for real fundamental change at the time. And he says, his opinion is that any failure to fulfill the promise of those days is not Mandela's fault. He says, history tells us that liberation movements do not so easily make the transition to stable democracies. Among other things, he says, they're defined by what they're against. And he goes on to say it was inevitable that once the shared enemy of white oppression was conquered, they would fall to quarreling over the direction and the spoils. And then he goes on to sort of compare South Africa with what he calls the shabby heritage of the Castros, the tyranny of Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe, the long nightmare of the Bolsheviks, et cetera, et cetera. What's your response to that?
Well, if I had a chance to have a beer with Bill Keller, which I did once about 15 years ago, he used to be the Johannesburg correspondent for the Times before he went up as editor. But, you know, I would say, look, this is nonsense. Really, Bill Keller's to blame. I mean, the pressures that came from the sort of international conservative establishment, or you know, responsible and serious people like Bill Keller at the New York Times, the pressures to adapt and surrender to kind of global corporate power were formidable. And I saw this so clearly. I wrote a book about it called Elite Transition. And the Bill Kellers, International Monetary Funds, and World Banks, who would come in and say, international experience shows, better not try something like Castro. Now, for Mugabe, it's a whole different story. It's the story, again, of talk left so you can walk right. But I think what Bill Keller and his ilk have always done is to put a, you know, it's kind of put a box around what's possible. And what was possible, we even spelled it out in about 150 pages in 1994. Mandela endorsed it. It was called the Reconstruction and Development Program. It was the African National Congresses and the Congress of South African Trade Unions, the civic movement and the women's movement, the education activists. Everyone bought into this RDP, Reconstruction Development Program. And I was asked to do, along with my colleague Misha Kosa, the audit of the RDP 5 years later for the African National Congress executive. And we found that only the most conservative aspects of what was possible were attempted. And those were mainly in repaying apartheid debt and maintaining fiscal and monetary balances. And the more radical opportunities to really redistribute were ignored. And those are clear in every single sector. And it's, I think, a very good explanation, the failure to do what was mandated for the huge number of protests. The police, Amy, are counting about 10,000 protests per year at the moment, along with China, which are in the 150,000 range per person. We're right up at the top of the world. And that means that the promises made in the Reconstruction and Development Program were broken. And every single step of the way, as I've tried to document in my writing, it was because the World Bank sent in its reconnaissance missions, had its allies, the Bill Kellers of the world, as conservative media gurus, kept saying, no, don't do any redistributive activity. Don't build a welfare state. Remember, globalization is good for you. And remember to liberalize, join the World Trade Organization, get rid of protection so that your industrial sector dies away. You don't need that anyway. And financially liberalize, let your rich people take their money away, repay the IMF for apartheid-era loans, and all of the sort of processes that help explain why we are the most unequal country with the most social tension in the world today.
I just also have to share that he also says that President Mbeki, basically praises him for creating a first world business climate that made outside investors feel welcome, sort of along with what you're saying. And he said the economy grew. Go on.
Well, the economy grew 5%, but in the same way that it did in the U.S., which was speculative finance and subprime kind of credit systems. And there was a little bit of a commodities bubble, but that didn't even help. I've documented this in great detail. But I think what Bill Keller, if I could have a beer with him again and say, look, Thabo Mbeki made it easy for big business, and the tax rate went from 48% to 30%. But big business, foreign investors especially, didn't come in, aside from a failed U.S. Malaysian corporate privatization of our state telephone company, aside from one of the big banks called ABSA being bought by Barclays. We know about Barclays and its corruption and interest rates, what's called LIBOR. Aside from those two big deals, we got pretty much nothing under Thabo Mbeki, and that was notwithstanding huge concessions to big business. So we're dealing with a local economy where big monopolies have suffered a sort of overaccumulation of capital. And Amy, they have one agenda: get their money out of this country, rip out the minerals from the ground. Lonmin Marikana massacre is probably the finest emblem, and I wish someone like Bill Keller could come back and give it some serious thought.
What do you foresee happening with this rapidly developing social movement? This is the last question.
Well, I think, Amy, 2013 is going to be very tense. The last half of this year included the wildcat strike wave that shocked the country, and the attempt to put a Band-Aid on it this last week from the African National Congress left only one faction in the society happy, and that was big business and Moody's, the international rating agency, the Financial Times, celebrating Cyril Ramaphosa, defending their interests. Nationalization of mines, including platinum, taken off the agenda, even though it would make a great deal of sense from any standpoint, common sense to say, well, we should take this huge asset, platinum, and control it. And I think that means that our tensions in this country will keep ratcheting up. What Marikana showed as well is that local people, workers, community members, women, some environmentalists could work together. And that's quite new, because we've seen a fragmented society, just like in the United States, where social movements, labor movements, community movements, women's movements, environmental movements have been fragmented. They work in silos, just working in their own little area, as sort of NGOs often do. And what we began to see in Marikana was the possibility of more unity and a strike wave that inspired so many other desperate workers, people who are massively indebted, as the U.S. subprime showed so many in the U.S. are. And these are the sorts of problems across the world leading to processes like Occupy. And we're a little bit behind the time. The North Africans had their revolutions a couple of years ago, really, with the Tunisians starting up. We're probably, as Thabo Mbeki's younger brother, Moletsi Mbeki, says, Tunisia Day in 2020. We're still a few years away from this process maturing, but it's on the way, and it's a very exciting place to be. I hope your listeners will keep an eye on South Africa.
We'll look for that story. Thank you so much for joining us, Patrick Bond. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Great to be back, Danny. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. I've been speaking with Patrick Bond, a political economist and senior professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal School of Development Studies in Durban, South Africa, where he directs the Center for Civil Society. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.